At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
An insurance treaty, a fiscal year limerick, and a dash of real-life noir. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us this Tuesday, December 30th. The CEO of Air Asia Today pledged compensation for families who lost loved ones on Flight 8501. Tony Fernandez said, quote, "We will not be running away from any of our obligations." The question is what those obligations are. And the answers at the outset appear awfully complicated. There are many factors in play: treaties, insurance, and building trust with the grieving. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Every airline has insurance for crashes, and the compensation response starts early, says air crash litigator Brian Alexander.
They're already doing that. You know, it's a go-team mentality.
Alexander is with the firm Kreindler and Kreindler.
There'll be folks at AirAsia itself that will liaison with the insurance company and its claims adjusters.
He says the key to payouts depends on each passenger's ticket. If a ticket starts and ends in Indonesia, where the flight took off from, a family could get less. Indonesia has not signed the newest aviation convention setting updated payouts.
That will be more of a negative for those folks as it relates to claims against the carrier.
It could be a matter of $23,000 versus $175,000 for different passengers. This flight was to land in Singapore, which has signed the new treaty. It gets more complicated, but in reality, airlines can pay what they see fit. Robert Jensen counsels airlines, and he advises, whatever the law, to make a first payment within 2 weeks.
Airlines have been encouraged, and most airlines have agreed to a minimum payment, and typically about $25,000 US. And that's given to every family.
He advises a second payout of at least $175,000.
For businesses, there's no question about where the bottom line comes into. You take care of the people, and the bottom line is always enhanced.
Of course, insurance companies cut the checks, and they're not in business to be generous. But Jensen says it's worth the airline making the payment. It will help the company in the end. If airlines don't establish trust with families, anger often leads to litigation, which can end up being more costly. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The U.S. Treasury Department has officially closed the books on the auto industry bailout that began in 2008. It just sold its last remaining stake in Ally Financial. All added up, the U.S. lost just over $9 billion in the plan to rescue automakers and lenders. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, that $9 billion can be seen as a pretty good deal.
President Obama hailed the official end of the auto bailout as a roaring success, claiming that taxpayers did recoup the $60 billion loaned out under his administration. The Treasury's final reckoning, however, shows the bailout cost taxpayers about $9 billion out of a total investment of $80 billion. That's between Presidents Bush and Obama. But some say simply looking at money spent versus money returned is not accurate.
the cost of doing nothing was not free, and that's not taken into account in the government's $9 billion number.
Kristin Dietschik is a director at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. She says had the government let GM and Chrysler go belly up, taxpayers would have been out much more than $9 billion.
Transfer payments to individuals in the form of government assistance, we would have taken in less in tax receipts. There would have been less personal income because those people wouldn't have jobs.
Dietschik says the government-led bankruptcy and bailouts ultimately saved about 1 million jobs and helped the companies get back on their feet much faster. Dan Eikenson is a trade economist at the Cato Institute, a free market think tank. He also says a simple dollars in and dollars out analysis obscures the big picture.
If you call a bailout a success, then it becomes a viable option next time, and the debate over whether or not to engage in it will be stunted.
Eikenson says the bailouts effectively robbed Ford, Honda, and other automakers of the spoils of capitalist success, and that future bailouts will likely follow. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The market swooned a bit today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow night, the ball will drop, we'll clink glasses of something bubbly, and 2014 will come to a close. For most businesses, the fiscal year will close too, but not all of them. Some companies close the books in March or July or even October. Marketplace's David Weinberg looked into why it is that not all businesses share the same fiscal cycle.
Time is relative. An hour to a person on their deathbed is like a tiny lifetime. For someone else, it could fly by while they play Candy Crush. Perhaps time is a concept best explored through poetry.
I'm Dr. Goose, the limerick writing economist.
Dr. Goose, a.k.a. David Lefkowitz, is a New York banker. He's here to help explain the concept of a fiscal year in a limerick.
A fiscal year is normally chosen as the time that the auditor goes in. It's often year-end, but that will depend on the month that the seasonal low's in.
Let's dissect that first line, a fiscal year is normally chosen. Normally, because most companies close their books on December 31st. But that doesn't make sense for some industries. Take agriculture, for example.
If I'm in the agriculture business, I'm going to want to choose a fiscal year that corresponds to the time when agriculture is at a lull.
Farmers often take on debt when crops are planted, think spring, and then hopefully pay off that debt and turn a profit when crops are sold, think fall. So it doesn't make sense to end the financial year while holding all that debt. Every industry is cyclical, so it makes sense that their fiscal year corresponds.
There's some March, which is usually retail. There's some June and then some September. And then every now and then you'll have what I would call like an off-quarter one, which would be, you know, February.
Alon Kalai teaches business at Columbia. He says ultimately it doesn't matter what date the fiscal year ends on because quarters are compared to quarters and years to years, regardless of when on the calendar they fall. Cheers. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
One company finishing 2014 on top, Fuhu. The technology company was Inc. magazine's fastest growing company of the year. They were also named Forbes magazine's most promising company in America. Fuhu's signature product is called Nobby. It's basically an Android tablet for kids. The company started in software in 2008. It made the turn to hardware in 2011. Since then, Fuhu has sold around 4 million Nobbies. It's grown in staff from 9 to 300. I met up with Fuhu president Rob Fujiaka and CEO Jim Mitchell at Fuhu's headquarters in El Segundo, California, to ask them about the company's explosive growth.
So what is, do either of you guys know off the top of your head, your current percentage growth as a company? I've seen these astronomical numbers.
I think last year I would estimate it at 158,000% growth.
So what does that mean for
give
a company?
Give or take 100,000.
Give or take 100,000%. When a company is growing that fast, I mean, there've got to be challenges. What's it look like inside when you're growing that quickly?
It's total chaos.
Really?
That's not a good thing to say, Don. Look, when a company is growing this fast, you're constantly running, and you're running at full speed.
It's like it is. I know Jim doesn't want me to say this again, but it's total chaos. And I would say this, that we're structured that way. One of the sayings that we have to our managers is that you have to learn how to run in the dark. And so when you look at big corporations, they are really made to have measured growth and to have measured losses. We're not really built that way. We are built as an entrepreneurial organization. That has changed over time as we start to get bigger. But overall, our soul is the heart of an entrepreneur, and that means that our company is made to make mistakes.
So one thing we haven't talked about is where we're sitting, and I wonder if one of you guys can describe this for us. We're in your conference room, but it is not a typical conference room.
Okay, so we're in a conference room. It has a 20-foot by 24-foot table.
So far it sounds pretty boring.
A white table. And I think what you're asking is, in the middle, it's instead of an open space, it's a big ball pit with thousands and thousands of red balls that you might see like if you were at McDonald's or something like that.
Can we get in the ball pit?
You can get in the ball pit, sure.
Will you guys get in with me?
Sure.
Okay, let's go.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. I've never done an interview in a ball pit before. Rob, why did you put a ball pit in the middle of your conference room?
You know, I think there's a couple – by the way, it was my son's idea, but really I did it for a couple of reasons. The first was to remind everybody that they're in a company that was made for kids. And the second, symbolically for all of us, was to showcase how each one of these individual balls combined can support and help people.
Why are these balls red?
Red is our color.
And why is red your color?
It's a basic branding fundamental, which is to choose a color that is the polar opposite in spectrum from the rest of the crowd, and the PC business as a whole is blue. And so red was an obvious choice for us from a branding perspective.
You have anything to add to our ball pit conversation?
I think I'm kicking you in the back.
I think he just put these in here so he could throw them at me when he was upset.
That was the other benefit of the ball pit.
And it wouldn't hurt so much.
So, Jim, have you seen a Nobby in the wild? What was it like to see the first time you saw a Nobby
in the wild? Yes. So the first time I saw a Nobby in the wild was on the Strand. I was walking down the beach with my – I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. And there was this kid and his parents, and he was playing on a Nobby Junior. And they were like, hey, there's a Nobby. And I went and I introduced myself to him, and they took a picture. We took pictures together. It was an amazing experience.
What did
fantastic.
It feel like?
Pride.
Really?
Yeah, total pride. It's just, it's a great feeling. It's not only a great feeling when you see other people using it, it's also a great feeling to go home and your kids know exactly what you do. You know, I spent 20 years as a partner at Accenture. It's a hard thing to explain what a consultant does to a little kid. Now I can go home and say, hey, try this new tablet, try this, right? And, you know, as Rob said earlier, our children are, in many ways, our inspiration to a lot of what we create.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for letting me get in the ball pit.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Coming up, real-life noir.
Noir stories, they don't always end tidily with all the loose ends sewn up.
Looking at the mystery of private detective Samuel Marlowe. But first, let's do the numbers.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average traded down 55 points, 0.3%, to close under 18,000 today at 17,983. The Nasdaq dropped 29 points, 0.6%, to 4,777, while the S&P 500 lost 10 points, about 0.5%, to finish at 2080. Retailers also had a tough day today. Tiffany fell 1%, JCPenney slipped 0.3%, and Nordstrom dropped 0.5%. Airlines, on the other hand, took off. United, Continental, American, and JetBlue all rose more than 1% today. Delta Airlines hiked 0.9%, and Southwest lifted 0.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday, December 31st, the final trading day of the year. We get a look at the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors issues its November Pending Home Sales Index. 2014 New Year's resolutions expire at midnight. Hey, I can totally lose 10 pounds by then. And New York City braces for a blizzard of more than 1 ton of confetti scheduled to hit Times Square. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Want to guess how much coffee was produced last year? If you said right off the top of your head 145,202,000 bags of coffee, you'd be exactly right. Those beans were picked and shipped from hillsides and fields from Burundi to Brazil, so I and the rest of the world's coffee drinkers can be revived every morning. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, it's the coffee industry itself that needs reviving, with hopes of perking up the entire economy. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Emil Tamirabali Batera is a coffee farmer in Batemba, South Kivu in eastern Congo. He's in a field just down the hill from his home. He's rebuilt both since Congo's wars.
We slept in the forest during the war.
This was in the 90s and early 2000s when Rwanda's genocide spilled over into Congo, bringing down the government and killing up to 5 million people.
My family would hide during the night wherever we could. During the day, we'd come back to work in our fields.
The war officially ended in 2002, but conflict has sputtered along since. For a time, agricultural commerce in his town was reduced to something economically primeval.
There was no cash, no money. We just bartered beans for salt, that sort of thing.
During better times, Batera's cash came from his coffee trees. They grow extremely well in eastern Congo.
During the war, the price of coffee beans went incredibly low. It just plummeted.
To give you an idea, prices paid to growers in Congo in 2002 were $2.96 per pound, the lowest in the world. Neighboring Central African Republic was getting four times as much. Batera's wife Josephine says it was just not worth all the work.
I'd have to start picking at 6 in the morning, pick all day, then pulp the beans by hand. My hands would get exhausted, dry them, then carry them to market.
The Batera's trees did not make it, at least not most of them.
I took out all the trees. Well, I left a few, but only because I drink a little coffee myself.
Many of their neighbors just stopped bothering altogether.
People burned or left their fields or grew other things, beans, cassava.
A thread of history got broken.
That is Dave Olson. He's worked in the coffee industry for 40 years, much of that time with Starbucks. He's also on the board of the Eastern Congo Initiative, a development organization. A lot of threads in Eastern Congo got broken, but the one Olson is talking about is the coffee industry.
Really good coffee can and used to be produced in this area.
But an industry is not like a piece of thread that you can just tie back together. It's more like a mirror. Easy to smash, harder to fix. You need a co-op for farmers, crop financing. If you're going to make good coffee, you need a machine to pulp and dry the raw coffee fruit, another machine to sort the good ones from the bad. And all of these shards of this mirror need glue, otherwise known as money. Conrad Britz is CEO of Falcon Coffee. It's a middleman sourcing coffee from around the world to large buyers.
Big multinational companies, top roasting companies, are
concerned about where they're going to get the raw material from to feed their factories in the next 20 to 25 years.
Brits has invested in Eastern Congo's shattered coffee industry because he needs to source coffee into the global supply chain, and he sees potential here.
The quality of coffee that comes off the tree in Kivu is some of the finest coffee in the world.
He's standing in front of hundreds of bags of coffee beans at the husking and sorting facility that he helped finance.
If you look at this, is a really uniform size bean of an even color, sort of a waxy green, sometimes blue-green.
Brits' money is just part of the equation. There are still a lot of broken coffee industry pieces on the ground, like how can farmers get their coffee to Brits Mill, and how can they get it there in good enough shape to be worth much? A big part of the solution to that is this. It's a pulping station, one of several now running in the region. This one was paid for by the Howard Buffett Foundation. Pale beans are spit out in one chute, and red and yellow pulp comes out another.
It saves us time and money, and we'll be able to produce quality coffee, which will then be sold at a competitive and profitable price.
That's Jean Munyamale Burafanwa, president of the coffee co-op. The beans are washed and sorted and dried on long tables, turned regularly so they don't develop what's called onion flavor before going to Brits Mill.
Little by little, everyone's starting to understand.
The co-op started with 20 members. Now it's at more than 1,300. Back on the Batera farm, Batera's wife Josephine is putting down compost. The Bateras say the prices they're getting haven't been seen in years.
We have gotten almost $1.75, $2 a kilo.
It's a lot easier.
Part by charity and part by business, the pieces seem to be coming together for Eastern Congo's coffee industry. The co-op's first shipment of specialty coffee is headed to Starbucks this month. In Kabemba, Eastern Congo, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Now to noir fiction and two iconic figures in the genre, Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe. Both detectives, both in Los Angeles, both depicted on the big screen by Humphrey Bogart. Today, there's a new mystery to solve, a real-life mystery. There are claims that both detectives were inspired by an actual private detective in Los Angeles named Sam Marlowe. The connection, if there is one, has been the subject of an investigation by Los Angeles Times reporter Daniel Miller. He spent months searching for letters that allegedly exist, letters that could prove that private investigator Sam Marlowe consulted with authors Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. Daniel Miller, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So spell out, if you will, the mystery of Samuel B. Marlowe.
So Samuel Marlowe was a black private detective who some people believe was the first licensed black PI in the state of California. And others believe he may have had a relationship with two very famous authors, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, two noir fiction writers. And basically, I spent the last year trying to prove that.
What do we know for sure? What did you discover?
So we know a lot about Marlowe's life, and it was an extraordinary life. He's a Jamaican immigrant. He fought in World War I and became a PI in 1921, according to newspaper reports. He had relationships with the movie studios and did work for them in South LA. There are things like that that we can say with some certainty. When it comes to whether he was friends with Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, that's the real mystery. That's something that we do not know for certain.
What would the job of a private investigator been when Marlowe was a PI?
Marlowe would have done things that I think people might find pretty mundane these days. For example, you could go on the internet and find out somebody's address. You could find out their age. You could find out if they've been arrested or sued. I think a lot of the work that Marlowe would have done would have been things that were that simple, using contacts at City Hall or with the police department to figure out if somebody he was investigating had a criminal record. And it probably amounted to hours and hours of monotonous work to get something like that done.
How unusual was it that there'd be an African-American private investigator in L.A. at that time?
Well, I spoke to a researcher at USC named Angelica Stoddard, who has made this a focus of her studies. And we do know that there were black private detectives in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. However, the records that would prove when he began as a PI are nowhere to be found. And that's a big part of this story, that a lot of the records that we were looking for are nowhere to be found.
Why do you think he could have been the inspiration for these incredibly famous noir characters?
In terms of a link between Marlowe and characters of Hammett and Chandler, probably one of the best examples is a claim that Dashiell Hammett sent an early draft of a story called Nightshade to Samuel Marlowe and basically suggested to Marlowe, and I'm paraphrasing here, you'll see I changed a few details, but I think this story still works. And in the story of Nightshade, there is a character who was revealed to be black, and he rescues a woman who's in distress and takes her to a speakeasy. Some of those details are sort of eerie because they mirror some of the things we've been told about Marlowe's work as a private detective in South L.A.
How does it feel, though, to not have cracked this? I mean, we never read detective novels without an ending.
Sure. Well,
we're at a point where there's no ending to this story yet.
That's right. I do like to tell people that, you know, noir stories, they don't always end tidily with all the loose ends sewn up. I would have loved to have sewn up a few more loose ends here, but we didn't. The story definitely continues. It's so provocative. Did Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, rely on a black private detective for technical advice when it came to shaping their famous noir characters, Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe?
Daniel Miller covers Hollywood for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go today, economists have a reputation for being a relatively serious lot. But maybe it's time we ought to rethink. Next week at the meeting for the American Economics Association, there'll be a panel called the 7th Annual Economics Humor Session. Among the papers that'll be presented there is one titled A Few Good Men, Surname Sharing Economist Co-Authors. It's written by four non-related economists, all with the last name Goodman. Get it? Get it? Goodman. Our main contribution, they write, is showing that such a collaboration is feasible. Yes, it is bizarre. And yes, it is funny, at least to me. One last thing. As we wrap up our 25th year on air, we want to invite you to celebrate with us. Hop on over to marketplace.org/25 years. Find the red button on the left side of the page. Click it and leave us an anniversary message. Maybe a limerick, a song, whatever your heart desires. We'd love to hear from you. And with that, we gotta go. Today, the Dow traded down 55 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq dropped 29 points, 0.6%. And the S&P 500 lost 10 points, about 0.5%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Adrienne Hill. Thanks for being with us. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.